No previously on this week. This week we wanted to take a moment to pay props to singer-songwriter and founding member of the Allman Brothers Band, Dickie Betts, who passed away last week at the age of 80. He'd been in poor health since he took a sidewalk spill a few years back, was in a coma for a while, and suffered a slight stroke. Our condolences and best to Dickie's family, and a notice that we'll be talking about him, his cohorts, and other makers of Dixie Rock when we offer up an episode in a few weeks entitled Southern Fried. In the meantime, trying to make a living and doing the best I can, mission accomplished, Dickie. Well played.
That's a lot of Dickies.
Chins up, boobs out, it's showtime.
Time for music.
Civilized conversation.
Wherever the music takes me, kitten.
Scott Edward Phelps.
Ah, yes, the legendary wit, or at least half of it.
Dave Simmons.
Good evening, Dave.
Can we not talk about sex so much?
Tell you right out, I'm a man who likes talking to a man who likes to...
The most important music show ever.
Cue inspirational music.
The Audiophiles.
Hi, I'm Hal Blaine. Let's play drums.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations.
This week, Good Vibrations, the music of Hal Blaine, part two, picking up where we left off from some weeks ago when we did Good Vibrations, the music of Hal Blaine, wait for it, part one. Couple of programming notes for you though. Hal Blaine passed away 5 years ago at the age of 90, so you might want to keep that in mind perspective wise in terms of some of the comments and observations and opinions that he had and expressed in the interview segment you're going to hear. Also, with a minor exception or two, all the music in this episode features songs that feature the legendary talents of the legendary drummer his own self, complete with us contributing fun facts to know and tell and simply superlative stories. So let the good vibrations roll. Hal Blaine, if you would, count it off, dude.
1, 2, 3, 4.
That's my most favorite Hal Blaine lick, because that's the only one I can do. Because a long time ago, when we talked about Hal Blaine several weeks ago, we kind of started out with his very beginning years, his education, his learning to mentoring with various and sundry great drummers of the times. And we brought him up to a point where he had worked with kind of his semi-first big gig. He worked with Tommy Sands, who was a teen idol of the late 1950s and early 1960s, mm-hmm. who was for about 20 minutes was Frank Sinatra's son-in-law. He was married to Nancy Sinatra. Tommy Sands was married to Nancy Sinatra, not Frank Sinatra. This was 1961, not 2024. But I think it's arguably said that Hal Blaine's first big gig, 1960, 1961, I should have put some of that harp music in, like for flashback, you know, memory. An industry friend gave Hal Blaine a call, requesting his presence with a new client. And he said to Hal,
"We're going to be doing a super secret project. I'd really like to have you on drums." He gave me a time to be at Paramount. There's going to be a meeting in one of the music rooms. And so I went there. First of all, they were not going to allow me to play any drums because they said, no, he works here as an actor. He's not a drummer. It took Colonel Tom and a couple other people to say, no, the man is a drummer. You know, I went back with Colonel Tom to the Tommy Sands days when he was managing Tommy Sands. So Colonel Tom knew that I was a straight, sober, good drummer, fair in the middle drummer. So that was the day I met Elvis.
The way she moves her hips up to her fingertips, I feel I'm heaven bound. And when she starts to sway, I've gotta say, she really moves the grass around. Rock, a hula baby, rock, a hula baby, got a hula loo from Honolulu. There's a rock, a hula baby of mine. Oh, well, there rock, a hula baby of mine.
Well, it ain't no clam bake.
No, well.
And it ain't no do the clamp. Can you imagine?
You know how I love clam bake, though.
I know you do. That's why I just poked you. You know, there's a wonderfulness about that material, and for me, my own self, it's not because, oh, it's Elvis, oh my God, because I was a Beatle kid, and I was a little bit too young to have gotten excited about Elvis. I was, you know, 56, 57 when he was really hot. I was like 6 years old. Who cares?
Right, right.
But can you imagine And I'm not going to start ragging on Beyonce or for any particular reason except just to use her as a measure right now. This latest Cowboy Carter thing with 114 tracks and all mm-hmm. the rest of that stuff. Can you imagine Elvis Presley coming around with 114 tracks of what he did and what he does? I mean, Clam Bake, Do the Clam, all that movie stuff.
Right, right.
And being treated with anything other than the contempt and or laughter that would accompany a Saturday Night Live sketch. And see people saying, are you fucking kidding me? I can't believe that that's what's going on
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
But that's what it was. And yet somehow there's son of a, it's like we talked last week about other music being comfort food. Because it's just, it was a, you know, every era has its problems, but it was just a nicer time.
It was a simpler time, yeah.
Well, it was a nicer time, yes. too. That's the larger mm-hmm. issue. And yeah. Hal Blaine right there playing away his little heart on Rockahula, one of the great.
Yeah, I always found it fascinating that, you know, because of the Tommy Sands connection
right.
with Colonel Parker, and then the Tommy Sands connection with Nancy Sinatra.
Right.
Points of intersection seem to fall at Hal's feet. On top of being incredibly talented, I think he was incredibly savvy, but he was also incredibly lucky.
There's the key.
You know what I mean? At that. And what I didn't realize is Hal played on just about every one of Elvis's movie albums.
Yeah. But, well, you go with the one that brought yeah. you. Once you get mm-hmm. a lot of performers. Leland Sklar, the bass player, has played on pretty much everything James Taylor ever breathed because yes, they hooked yeah. up together when they were in college back in the late 1960s. Same thing. You know, you dance with the devil you know. But you're right about his luck, and that's not taking a single thing away from his talent. No. But I can guarantee you this, none of Hal Blaine's autobiographies are entitled So Close.
Is that is true.
For those of you who may remember the reference last week.
Yes.
Speaking, and it's an interesting, insightful point that you make, young Lochinvar, with that whole interconnectivity thing. Because you talk about Elvis, you talk about Hal Blaine, you talk about, well, then you start talking about John Lennon. And that would be time for, I'm Hal, and this is Elvis, and then there's that John Lennon guy.
I'm Hal Blaine.
No influence at all. Elvis liked friends as opposed to strangers hanging around, who amongst us don't. Hal explains the thing and the why, and he also talks about one other superstar friend that he made who proved to be a musical genius and an almost literal Jekyll and Hyde.
Elvis always liked people around him that he kind of knew. He didn't like strangers around him, but I got along famously with Elvis, and it was obviously quite a feather in my cap because I had been working with all these superstars, and Elvis knew a lot of the work that I had done. When I did the John Lennon album, just before he was killed, I used to sit and have talks with Lennon, who was sober and just charming. And after about three drinks, he never knew it was the same guy. He was an outrage on sessions, not necessarily with the musicians, but anybody around. I mean, engineers that he would pick on, and big shots. Some of the Warner Brothers people came over to meet him. They had never met him, and they were paying all the bills. And he started cursing them out something terrible. They just kind of backed out of the room, and they were gone. But you don't do that to the president of Warner Brothers and Mo Austin. You don't do that to people. But, of course, that was John Lennon when he was drinking.
Think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
You know, we heard stories when we were kids, and it was kind of post-Beatles, not during the Beatlemania days or even the time they were still together, that John was a real dick when it came to the vine, the juice.
Well, you know what
he wasn't a good drinker.
You know what he used to love? The drink was Brandy Alexander's.
Yeah.
Brandy and milk. And
the healthy one.
Yes. But he, that's what he was drinking the night of the Smothers Brothers
episode
at
the Troubadour.
Yeah, with
tampons and Harry Nilsson.
Harry Nilsson, yeah. Oh my God. And
from the forthcoming autobiography, Me, Tampons, and Harry Nilsson.
So yeah, it's well known that Lennon was an angry drunk.
Isn't it interesting though? I don't know. I would say how old? What year was Hal Blaine born in? With all of our talking about him, I don't know right off the top of my head which year
that
he was born in.
That was on the.
What's her name over there?
Is it Alexa?
Alexa, yeah.
Alexa, what year was Hal Blaine born?
Okay, 1929. Yeah, so that means he was 11 years. He was marginally a generation older than Lennon.
Lennon, yeah.
So then, and it's kind of telling with that, you know, you don't behave that. And this was a hip, groovy guy.
Yeah.
You don't behave that way in front of record executives. You don't treat that people with those. And as in West, I would argue, and not in John's defense, but the truth of the matter is, well, apparently from Hal's own testimony, Lennon didn't. But then you have a little of the sauce, and sauce makes you say things you don't want to say. Just ask most of my ex-wife.
And Pete, they covered it up in the Beatles quite a bit. Because
well, sure.
With his drinking, I mean, he's the one that kicked Stuart Sutcliffe in the head. He's probably the one that killed Stuart inadvertently.
So the urban legend says, but yeah.
So, I mean, it's just.
But you know what? Karma.
Yes.
And you know what karma came in the form of?
It did Mark David Chapman. No.
Yoko.
Oh, Yoko.
And then Mark David Chapman.
Well, maybe that was relief.
Oh, my God. That's kind of depressing a little bit.
You're listening to Scott Edward Phelps, Dave Simmons,
and Hal Blaine. Now we're going to put our bass drum and our hi-hat together.
Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, All You Cats and Kitties from 1957, and a big hit for them, and it was be covered by many artists through the years, and that cover right there is the Beach Boys from 1964. I was that day years old last week going through some of this material, and I know lots of stuff because I've lived a long time, and what I don't know, I just say I do because I'm old now and you have to listen to my shit. But here's the thing. Their cut of... Why Do Fools Fall in Love, the Frankie Lyman tune, was the B-side of the 45 single of Fun, Fun, Fun.
Oh, really?
Till Daddy Takes the T-Bird Away. Mm-hmm. And here's your interconnectivity, okay, as you were just mentioning a minute ago. At the session, because they apparently did the Fun, Fun, Fun recording and the B-side. In those days, by the way, that's an interesting archive thing if you're interested, folk out there. In the way these things worked. Look at some of the older documentaries, but do some reading on the wiki or the Google, and you'll discover that the concept of spending 9 months in a studio to make an album or 11 months or 2.5 weeks to get a drum sound, you know, that's a current contemporary 21st century thing. Back in the day, the Beatles' first album was recorded
one day
in a single day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some of the songs sound like it sonically and tonally, but it didn't matter because they were doing it.
Well, that's why they held Twist and Shout to the end, because Lennon's voice was shot.
And that's what made it an iconic track.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So Fun, Fun, Fun and the B-side, which were their interpretation of Frankie Lyman's tune, were recorded in one day. And in the studio down the hall, it turned out, somebody heard that the Beach Boys were in, and this particular someone was a fan of Brian Wilson, and so wandered down into the studio and hung out for a while. And yes, we're talking about
Elvis.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So Elvis Presley was present during the session when Fun, Fun, Fun was recorded. That song, and Hal Blaine is playing on both those tracks. So once again, Elvis comes in. Now, here's the other connectivity. When asked how he first became acquainted with John Lennon, Hal Blaine offered that Paul McCartney wasn't exactly the only big Brian Wilson fan back in those days.
I used to have nice talks with him. John Lennon, sober as a judge, the Beatles were big fans of the Beach Boys. And I did all the Beach Boys records. I mean, 99.9% of the Beach Boys records. And so he was, in fact, all of the Beatles were familiar with the fact that we were doing those records, that Brian Wilson was hiring a few people. We had Ray Pullman. A lot of people don't know that name, but Ray was really the big guy. Joe was with Ricky Nelson. Joe and I, we did everybody. Larry Nechtel, myself, and Joe Osborne, they called us the Hollywood Golden Trio. We did so many albums. Did all that stuff with Johnny Rivers and The Fifth Dimension. It just goes on and on and on and on. We did so much.
Make your own kind of music.
From her post Mamas and Papas period, that's Cass Elliott, and her hit, that was a hit for her in the early 1970s. And who's on the drums?
Hal Blaine.
He was talking about Johnny Rivers, The Fifth Dimension, all these artists and groups that they started. He started playing for along the way.
And I bet you Steve Barry produced that because he was doing most of Mama Cass's solo stuff.
Yeah, could be. That's Barry with an I.
Yes, B-A-R-I.
In case you're looking him up on the Wickle.
Yes.
On the Wiki and the Wickle. And then along came, well, along came.
We came into the studios with Levi's and t-shirts, smoking cigarettes. The older guys were saying they're going to wreck the music business.
The Wrecking Crew was the focal point of the music. They were the ones with all the spirit and all the know-how.
We would either augment or totally replace a group.
They were the stone-cold rock and roll professionals, and there may never be a group of that caliber again.
Glenn Campbell doing an impression of the opening riff of his
Carol
own big
Kay's
hit
riff,
song,
yeah.
Carol Kay's riff. All right, so the Wrecking Crew. Interesting, in the little excerpt just before, Hal makes mention of, and I hadn't heard that before until I heard that snippet of interview. The two other guys he was working with pre-Wrecking Crew, they called themselves the Hollywood Golden Trio. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
It's amazing if you look up enough stuff, how you learn stuff. Well, from that nucleus, of course, came the backing group known for generations now as the Wrecking Crew. And what you heard there, by the way, was the audio track of the video trailer for the documentary, The Wrecking Crew. And the voices you may or may not have recognized, speaking voices, Brian Wilson was in there, Glenn Campbell, of course. I think Jimmy Webb was one of those making a comment.
And Leon Russell.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen that documentary, that's one of the best documentaries I've ever watched.
It is. It says right here on my little notes, it's a must-see. It's must-see TV. It's probably available on streaming services, too. But behind the scenes, and that's kind of what the documentary was all about, behind the scenes of the making of the music, there was more than music going on behind the scenes. There was some good old-fashioned, because it's muggles, it's people, it's egos, it's musicians, old-fashioned soap opera drama. Now, that came in the form of what has, for years now, been rightfully labeled as a feud. We've had a little touch on that. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. But the battle lines were drawn not only between gender and chops and priorities and egos, but with a little gender conflict, too. So the Wrecking Crew movie, the documentary, came out, and the feud bubbled to the surface. Hal Blaine let it be known he was not a happy camper about the documentary when it came to a certain lady who purported to play on much of the great 60s music, but perhaps it turns out not as much of that music as the legend might suggest. Mr. Hal Blaine, along with everything else, he minces absolutely no words.
The only thing I have to say about the movie that really pisses me off, excuse my French, and that is Carol Kay, who should have been in the goddamn movie with us, and who's out there now telling the world there never was a Wrecking Crew, that Hal Blaine wrote a book called The Wrecking Crew, and he was just trying to push his own book. She forgets I'm in the fifth printing of my book right now.
Right.
Big deal. You don't make any money on books unless you're selling multi-millions, you know, and get on a number one New York Times list or something. She's just absolutely ridiculous. She's become an absolute saboteur.
She's a fool. She's a fool.
By the way, we'd like for legal purposes to make sure everyone understands, Mr. Hal Blaine chose the music excerpts to follow his conversation along the way.
Yes, for sure.
He was not happy. And I'll tell you something. You and I and even our association, quote unquote, with Carol Kay is relatively new, but we've spoken with her. I interviewed more on that.
Can we tell people we've spoken to her?
That I saved that for a little bit later for a purpose that'll be obvious to you when we talk about it. But I talked to her the first time in a phone interview that I did with her right around 2002, 2003. She does love to talk, and she does love to talk about herself, but I didn't know, and I knew there was some feuding going on from what I had read through the years, but it wasn't until we started really digging into Hal's thing that I learned, and you heard him.
Yes.
I'd never heard that interview segment before, and he was pretty blunt about the way he felt about it. She was pretty blunt, too, when we talked to her about that.
She had a lot to say about Hal.
You know, you'd think they were married the way that they
were. It's crazy. And anything that we're saying, or even anything that Hal says, doesn't take away from her talent and what she gave to the music.
Dave's reading that off an index card given to him by our lawyer.
thought we'd bring it up.
No, I don't know what Hal, you know what? I don't know what Hal's problem was with her because she loves us.
Hi, I'm Carol Kay. You're listening to Scott Edward Phelps and Dave Simmons, the audiophile.
Sounds pretty chipper.
She loved us until right after that point.
Well, again, that's coming up a little later. Let's let Hal continue banging on her for just a minute. No pun intended. In that same interview, Hal goes on to offer, well, let me do my NPR voice for this one because I think it'll be fun that way. Hal Blaine went on then to offer a detailed analysis of the psychological ramifications of the dispute between the various parties involved in the controversy and summed up what his psychological interpretation was of Carole Kay's state of mind at the time.
Absolutely, completely nuts. She's a guitar player. Phil Spector wanted to give her a break because she had a couple of kids, just as he did with Sonny Bono. I mean, Phil was a sweetheart of a guy, and Carole was part of these sometimes seven guitars sitting there. She was never a part of the wrecking crew. She was augmented sometimes, and we'd call her if there were three, four, five other guitar players, but she was never, and all of a sudden she started fooling around with the bass fiddle, and it wasn't the bass at first, it was that other instrument, very soprano-ish type. It's between a stand-up bass and a Fender. Anyway, unfortunately, the guy that did all that Fender work was Ray Pullman, one of the great arrangers, one of the great bass players, and Carole Kay has the nerve to take all those credits and sue people. She has sued Guitar Player Magazine, Bass Player Magazine. She wants to be known as the first lady of the bass, and she is not and never was. Bass players laugh at her. She's the most litigious person on the planet. The courts got very sick of her. She pulled some things with Earl Palmer, the great drummer. Earl's widow, Jolene, is a very dear friend of mine, very nice lady. And when Earl died penniless, unfortunately. And, of course, we all found out, we all knew that. And his widow, Jolene, had savings. She was paying all these medical bills and on and on and on. Carole Kay comes along. Now, Earl had something like eight children. And she tells all these children, oh, Earl left millions for you. They're just not telling you. And that created such a, you have no idea what it created for Jolene. This poor lady who knocked her brains out the last 5 years that Earl was laying in a bed that she was paying for, right. a hospital bed, and in the home. It was her home. You have no idea what Carole has pulled and what she's done, and she's become the laughing stock. And I mean, all the great bass players, they laugh about her. They don't even want to know her. She had the nerve to come along and say, there never was a wrecking crew. We were known as the Click. She was known as the Click in her brain, I guess. I don't know. I don't think it ever clicked, though.
The devil in disguise, or as you are, devil in disguise.
Yeah, you'll see it didn't affect Hal's playing at all. I have a question about that segment when I heard it the first time, and I thought, let me make a note of that, and I'll ask Dave, because sure. Dave is all-knowing and wise. Here's my thing. Here's my takeaway from what he had to say there. If Ray Coleman, if Carole Kay didn't play on a lot of stuff that she reports and purports to have played on and is listed on her website and all the conversations I've ever seen her have, including the interview we did with her plus the interview I did with her 20 years ago, if she didn't play on a lot of that stuff, and we won't say she didn't play of any because who's to say now because Hal's dead and,
right.
You know, Carole's not feeling so good herself. But here's my, and I think this is the really key question of the whole thing, if you ask me. If Ray Coleman played on the majority of that material, and that was a lot of sessions and a lot of work and a lot of brain drain and everything else, how the hell did he find the time and energy to have eight kids?
Yeah, that is true. That's a good point.
You know, he died of dehydration is probably what
it
is.
Yeah, probably.
I'm just saying.
Shooting dust. But, yeah, that's I think Carole started to get some of the overflow because very much like Earl Palmer got so busy, he gave Hal his overflow, and that's kind of got Hal started.
Sure.
I think that's what Ray did with Carole.
But Carole doesn't see it that way.
No,
and I'm,
of course.
You know that, but I'm saying, well, Carole has never seen. And I got to tell you, there's a little personal disappointment on my part, and I'll tell you why. This gets back to the interconnectivity. We've gone thus far. We're about halfway home, and I haven't mentioned his name, but the first time I ever really realized or thought about who Carole Kay was.
Billy Strange?
Was Billy Strange, yeah. Because they were very close.
Yes.
He played on a tremendous amount of that stuff, yet he never promoted himself as a member of the Wrecking Crew.
Right, right. He's in the movie as well.
Yeah, yeah, and rightly so, because mm-hmm. he was there for a lot. He did a lot of what Hal Blaine did when he said he played on 99.9% of the Beach Boys material. Billy was there at the beginning and played a lot of the lead guitar stuff on the early Fun, Fun, Fun.
Right, right.
Dance, 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 when Brian was in a mood to write songs that had three words in the title. That was Mike Love. But That was Billy.
Right.
But Billy was a gracious guy, and he was a humble guy.
Yeah, very humble.
Super talented. He drove me nuts the last few years of his life when he and I were still communicating with each other, and I kept getting into his shit about writing his damn autobiography, which he never did.
Mm-hmm.
And I even told him, literally, that's how close we became, that I was able to say to this man to his ear, you know, on the phone, man, you're depriving the world of the joy of reading your life. And yeah, I know, but... Well, he told me frankly at one point, he said, you know, you've been on my case about this for years. I'm going to tell you the real reason I haven't done it. It's too damn much work digging all that stuff up and looking in the files and trying to find those stories and all the rest of that. Let people find out themselves.
Because, yeah, I'm sure he played sessions that he doesn't remember. He's on records.
But anyway, he was the one who kind of, he didn't introduce me to Carol, but I remember 20 years ago when I got the chance to talk to her, I used Billy's name as the wedge to get her to respond, which she did, and she was quite gracious in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But then I kind of bought hook, line, and sinker what she was selling, that she was here and she did that and she did that. Now, listening to Hal Blaine, and we're not saying she didn't play on any of the stuff. She wasn't a total pretender. Right. She was there.
Well, during our conversation with her, the fact that, and you'll remember this, I brought up Fast Eddie Ho.
Right.
Who drummed on like most of the late Monkey stuff.
Right.
She didn't even know who he was.
Well, she said she didn't know who he was. And that kind of interestingly, I should have the organ music, psychologically ties into something that'll come up toward the end of the show this time around that we'll share with you how she, and again, I don't want to turn this into a Carol Kay bonfire because Lord only knows there's already a couple of voodoo dolls with pins in them with our names on them for what we did with the conversation the first time around.
Right.
Unintentionally. All right, speaking of Brian Wilson, Beach Boys material, etc., when it came to Carol's work on the Beach Boys material, Hal shared in another interview that Brian Wilson was, at least at the time and on that subject, pretty clear about exactly or what his understanding was of what was and what was not reality.
We talked to Brian about that. He said, you know, she's a woman, she's got children, we got to help her out. Fine, that's all well and good, but don't turn around and then try to stab us in the back. Let me tell you a quick story. When Denny told me that Carol was going to be part of this first little round table, there were just four of us, Tommy Tedesco, myself, Plaz Johnson, and Carol. And I said, why is Carol with us? She's not a part of us. Well, she's a girl. She has a couple kids, and we want to help her. This is 20 years ago. I said, Denny, I'll tell you something right now. I have nothing against Carol. But any question you ask any of us, she's going to answer. And that's exactly what he hates himself to this day, because it took forever for him and his editor to take out so much of her talk. It was all BS. She's just a terrible liar. And I was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with the great bass player from Detroit,
James Jamerson.
Carol Kay found out it was James Jamerson. She went to her email list and sent everyone letters and told them they should write to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame that it should be her, because she did all of the Motown records. She's totally nuts. Everybody in the business knows she's made a fool of herself. Anyway, that's our Carol. That I'm sure gonna miss her. Sure gonna miss her. I'm sure gonna miss her. Yes, I am.
Gary Lewis and the Playboys and one of their singles hits from that 1965, I think, stack of stuff. And on the drums, I think you can guess who?
Mr. Blaine.
I was just surprised when I came across these particular interviews and did some chopping and cutting myself to be able to use these segments. I was surprised at the level of vitriol, and I was surprised at how much of a gap there is in the assertions of who did what and who didn't do what. I can see them kind of maybe, I was laboring under the impression there was some old age foggy memories about whether I was there at that session or that session or not.
But this sounds just dislike. That's what it is.
Yeah. But you know, well, and again, not that it makes a hell of a bit of difference, but if somebody held a gun to my head and said, you got to pick one of them to believe, I'd be inclined. If I was on the
show, I'd pick Hal.
I'd pick Hal too now, yeah. From with what I've heard and then our own experience. Yeah. But in fairness now, I should offer up that, first of all, Hal's dead, so he can't defend himself,
right.
Try to get him on the phone and have some fun with it. Although sure, he seemed affable and ready to talk about it at a moment's notice. But I didn't get, through any of those interviews, I didn't get any sense of him feeling threatened.
No.
He was pissed, and he was probably frustrated with having to deal with the stuff that he felt like was true or not true. But that was different when we spoke with Carol. There was a defensive kind of feeling that she projected that made it seem like, you know, you does protest too much at some point.
Right. And the other thing, the thing she was telling us about Hal made no sense.
Right.
You know, and that's the other thing.
Well, and again, in fairness to her, I'm reading off the index card provided by our lawyer. In fairness to her, I'm just kidding. Old age plays a part, and I'm not putting down. I'm testifying. I couldn't find my keys this morning to save my life, and they were in my hand most of the time. All right. Oh, I know what this is fun.
Hi, I'm Carol Kay.
Absolutely, completely nuts.
And Dave Simmons, the audiophile.
She stepped on my name, not your name, so that works for me. All right, this is an unheralded and unannounced. Dave doesn't know I'm springing it on him. We're a little ahead of schedule, believe it or not, for the first time, and I thought, take a break for just a second and throw up another question. A more contemporary question, because it's a yearly ritual. Dave and I share this together. It's kind of like our Christmas time or our Thanksgiving holiday season, where we lock hands and look into each other's eyes, and I go, "Hey, inductee's been announced, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
How
you feeling? Let's do 30 seconds on how they suck and the monkeys are never going to get in there."
Hey, there's only one monkey left. You need to put them in so Mickey can get the feel. I mean,
let me ask you something.
Yes.
Don't you think now, and this is just me, and I know this is going to sound like Miss Debbie Downer, but it's not meant that way. I'm thinking intellectually, not emotionally. Don't you think now it's to the point where even if they get in, it's like it's just because there was fun. It's like the being picked for the ball teams when we were in school.
And you're the last pick.
You're the last kid. Oh, look, I'm on the team. Yeah, that's because we didn't have anybody else to choose from anymore. Yeah. And it's almost like faint praise now.
Right. You're right. And it's the thing that has always bothered me is the monkeys had everything that the Beatles had.
Except Yoko.
Except Yoko. But I mean, you know, the good songs, the cultural, you know, they affected the culture, not to the extent of the Beatles, obviously.
Right.
But I mean, and then you look at individually, Mike Nesmith created MDV.
Yeah.
I mean, that was one of the biggest things that ever happened in music.
I don't think there's any question how stupefying it is that they've been overlooked all this time, except what I've said since day one of day one is that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is an academic uselessness. It's just an exercise in vanity, and you spell vanity J-A-N-N-W-E-N-N-E-R, Jan Wenner. And even though they finally booted him off the executive board, there's still a mentality that's involved there.
Yeah, and they're being persecuted for having people play on the records while the Beach Boys did. They're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The Birds did. They're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. All of these other bands that the Wrecking Crew played on. But the monkeys are the ones that actually outed that.
You know, I know that. I think it has something. No reporter that I'm aware of has ever shoved a microphone right up in Jan Wenner's face and said, "What's your fucking problem with the monkeys?" I have a sneaking suspicion that Mike Nesmith must have punched a hole in one of Jan Wenner's offices at some point along the way, and it was a personal grudge.
He probably.
There's no other, and I'm just teasing that, but there's no other reason for them to be excluded except a personal grudge.
Right. And Mike Nesmith very well, he could be a little feisty.
But I think at this point it's like, hey, the monkeys are in, and it's kind of like Susan Lucci when she finally won the Emmy after being nominated 306 times. It's like, okay.
But it would be something for the fans. To them, I'm sure. It'd well, to three of them, they don't you. Care now. For three out of the four of them, it doesn't matter.
All right. Meanwhile, back at Hal Blaine,
Believe it or not, for a moment or two, we're not going to talk about Carole Kay.
I'm Hal Blaine.
O.J. Simpson died recently.
Yes.
May he rest in peace. And remember, as we said last week, he died with his knife and children by his side. And Hal Blaine was a player in another famous celebrity shooting. That would be Phil Spector, who was the creator of the Wall of Sound back in the late 50s, early 60s, and in the mid-60s, and killed this girl. He was a gun-wielding weirdo. At the time of this next segment with Hal Blaine at that interview, Spector was in prison for life where he was sent after the killing. And he died in prison in recent years. And Hal Blaine spoke his mind at the time in the segment about what really, in his estimation, happened in the whole Phil Spector murder case. Beginning, Hal Blaine did a little stand-up comedy. A little rock and roll ba-dum-bump, Hal Blaine.
You know that Phil in prison, he's working on a new band called the Wall of Sound, but they call it the Prison Wall. And we all know that he did not murder this woman. He had the gun, and it killed her, but he did not intend murdering her. People, for some reason, and Phil was a very little guy, he had that Napoleonic thing that he was the big man on the campus, and that's all there was to it. And he pulled guns on a lot of people. Over 30 years, I never saw a gun. The L.A. detectives were here with me for 3 hours on my patio recording me, and I had to convince them I never, ever saw a gun. All the talk of the Ramones saying, well, he pulled a gun on us, they're going to kill you if you don't do it my way. Even one of the Ramones said that was all BS. They never saw a gun. 33 years, I never saw a gun.
You know, there's a little, I think there was probably a brotherly-like relationship to some extent between Hal Blaine and Phil Spector, because the beginning of that segment where he's talking about, he held the gun, he wielded the gun, he was with the gun around the lady, but he didn't murder the lady. It's kind of like, oh, honest judge, I was just standing on the corner cleaning my fingernails with my knife when this guy came flying around the corner and ran into my knife accidentally 32 times in the back.
Yeah, that was that. And the funny thing is, if you read about that trial, Phil Spector was out of his ever-loving mind.
Well, he's always out of his mind. Yeah, he was, well, and Hal Blaine called it and spoke his piece, the Napoleonic thing. Spector was a little 4'2" guy, and he just didn't have the inner confidence to be, which is kind of sad and tragic and all those other Hallmark card goodies, because he was a very talented guy.
Oh, yeah.
Masterminded a major genre, if you will, of popular music back in the late 50s and into the 70s.
Well, the funny thing is they said, like, most people were afraid of him when they were working with him.
Well, if you're waving a gun in somebody's face.
That's, I don't know if you've seen the footage of John Lennon just berating him.
Well, Leonard was drunk. He had to be drunk.
Well, no, he's like, Philip, it's the chorus is the same as the other chorus. The fucking chorus is the chorus. And he's get it together, Philip.
And how did Phil react? See, that's the beauty.
Phil never said anything.
That's the beauty, you know, of that whole thing right there, is what I'm talking about.
It's like John Lennon yelling at you, you're going to shut up, you know?
That's right. Well, then karma shows itself in the form of Yoko, to be followed by Mark David Chapman. All right, Dave's got some faves when it comes to Hal Blaine, and one of them kicks off Dave's faves.
Dave Simmons.
Hey, Dave.
Hey.
What you got? What's up?
Popsy.
We'll be right back.
That is a really cool song called Topsy.
Tell me something. Is that the actual name of that piece?
Yes. That's a Count Basie song from the 30s.
Okay. Because I remember hearing that song as a kid, and I remember hearing that song used in lots of different venues and genres and movies and TV.
Yeah, 1937 it was written.
Okay. I just never knew it was called Topsy.
Yeah. Yeah. Hal Blaine put out an album. It was called Drums, Drums, A Go-Go. Uh-huh. And he did a bunch of instrumental songs. Like, Hal always played for the song 99.9% of the time. But there are these, and there are two of these songs that I picked up that where he really shows the chops he had. I mean, he was heads and shoulders above most people of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And
and life is life, and that's the way it goes. But it occurs to me, what a joy it would be if he was around today, or if he'd been, well, everything would have been skewed in the space-time continuum. But my point in my brain is the sonic quality.
Oh, yes.
Of the drumming and the way that they did or didn't mic drums and the sound. I can imagine what Hal Blaine's drums would sound like today.
Oh, yeah.
If they could be recorded with the technology that's available today. That's kind of a loss almost.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame. But that was produced by Sloan and Barry. Phil Sloan, Steve Barry.
Who are responsible for a number of hits back in the 1960s.
Eva Destruction.
Eva Destruction. Mm-hmm. A Must to Avoid. Herman's Hermits.
Herman's Hermits. Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm flashing on record labels in my head. They're flying past me at 100 miles an hour. Because I was one of those geek kids. When I was 13 and 14, while my friends were trying to figure out where their feet were, I was laying there reading record labels, 45 labels.
Publishers'
names, the parentheses underneath to see who wrote them and those kinds of names.
The artists that played on them, yeah. Yeah, yeah the studio musicians, I mean... That's why being good friends with Bernard Purdy freaks me out a little bit, because as a 12-year-old, I'm reading his name on all these records, and now I'm friends with him. It's a weird thing.
Yeah.
But Blaine had I kind of wondered if Blaine ever played with Count Basie. Hmm. And I found an interview.
Uh-huh.
And he says, I'll never forget when we worked at the Waldorf Hotel in New York City with the Count Basie band. Count's drummer, Sonny Payne, had gotten sick, and I got to play the gig. I knew most of the charts, and now there I was kicking it with my favorite big band. It was every drummer's dream in those days to play with Count Basie. Count Basie even offered me a job at that point. And he said, I was flabbergasted, but I explained that Tommy's job was my job, and I couldn't think of leaving the group. Mm. So that was when he was with Tommy Sands.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really cool that he actually played with Count Basie.
And for those of you contemporaries who are trying to figure out what the hell he's talking about, Count Basie was a great big band / jazz, but more like in the big band grooving kind of thing. He was not the count on Sesame Street.
No.
And he was not the guest star on Svengoolie any time in recent past, if you want to look him up. It's a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
Plus, he's responsible for a number of iconic pieces of music. History, you hear them, you go, oh, you call them, oh, yes. You hear the name of this, like me. If you'd have said Topsy a week ago, I'd have gone, oh, but if you played me that first lick.
Right.
Well,
I've heard that in TV shows. I've heard it in movies.
What I'm saying.
Yeah.
There you go. All right. So the other piece, this is interesting, the other of Dave's faves, this is more interconnectivity, because the recording artist recorded a song of mine back in 1990, whenever the hell it was, and I never made a dime off of it. But I can say... Well, I'll say after. Let's play the tune first.
Of a drummer man.
And immediately following the session, they threw Billy Joe McAllister off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Didn't that have kind of a, if Ode to Billy Joe had been done with a little more groovy, that's what it would have sounded like.
Yeah, the feel on that song is incredible. Now, you know who produced that?
I don't.
Billy Strange. He arranged, produced, yeah.
Well, I should have gone with that as a guess because he was Nancy's mm-hmm. major musical mentor.
You know, that's 1969, by the way, and that's from the Move In With Nancy album.
Yeah. That was the year I graduated from high school.
There you go.
And I'd never been
there. You know what I could not find? I could not find a list of the session players on that anywhere because I wanted to know who was playing bass.
On that album?
Yeah, on that song. So, you know, that.
Well, if anybody out there is totally geeked to the point where you've got access to resources like that, check it out for Dave, and it's a real cheap birthday present.
You can do that. But I think I played that for you a few, maybe 10 shows back, 11 shows back. It's one of my favorite Hal Blaine performances just because it's so drum heavy.
I was going to say the joke is more cowbell, but in this case, no, more drums. I don't think so.
And in case you're wondering, that's the famous drum kit. The plexiglass with all the toms, the one that the guy that made the kit made two sets, made one for him and one for Ringo because George Harrison ordered for Ringo.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So that's that famous kit, that the fiberglass kit that he had made for
him. Well, nobody can say that the drums weren't up in the mix.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
The way it should be.
Hi, I'm Carol.
Never should have been in the goddamn movie with us.
It's time to calm down now, Hal, because we're getting close to the grand finale.
Two guys who know tunes. Talking Tunes, the Audiophiles.
And now, the grand finale.
So that's it? Gone? Boo-hoo?
Well, I hope you've all been practicing real good.
Mm-hmm, I know that's right.
Oh, hell
yeah!
That's right, because that's what we do. Yep, there's got to be a last word on Carol Kaye, and the last word on Carol Kaye, it's only fair to give it to Hal Blaine. And he wraps up the whole thing of Mabob with a nice, big, juicy anecdote.
I get a call one day from a reporter in Hollywood. He said, I'm coming out to do an interview with Carol Kaye, and she seems to live near you. Would it be possible to talk to you after Carol? I said, sure, come on by. So this was like on a Saturday, and he was going to see Carol at around 12 o'clock. He was going to see me about 1:30. Well, about 10 minutes after 12, he's knocking at my door. I said, hey, man, come on in. What happened? I thought you were doing Carol. He said, she threw me out. I said, what are you talking about? He said, my first question to her was, Miss Kay, can you tell me if any of the bass players that you fashioned yourself and learned from, etc.? And she said, no, I never learned from anybody. And the guy said, I was under the impression that Joe Osborne had been the bass player on so much of it. I hate Joe Osborne. He stole everything I ever did. And get out of my house. I'm not talking to you. Joe Osborne, for Christ's sake, was with Ricky Nelson in the 50s playing rock and roll. Anyway, don't get me started.
Leave me alone. Leave me alone.
The lady who gave us I Am Woman, Hear Me Roar, and Hal Blaine, and that wonderful little thing called Ruby Red Dress, one of Helen's follow-up hits, subtitled Leave Me Alone. And this is why I said we were going to talk about this a little bit in the latter part of the show, was why I said earlier that of the two personalities, the interview stuff we've heard Hal Blaine do, the interview stuff we've heard Carol Kaye do, both literally and with our own thing, is mm-hmm. that the difference is that Hal sounds annoyed and frustrated and pissed off, but he never sounds threatened.
No.
Indicative of, was that we, our impression was that Carol felt threatened for whatever reason, and that's her prerogative, but this is a perfect example. And, you know, we've avoided politics. I've avoided it so far this entire episode. But right now, I have to tell you, if that's not Donald Trump in drag, there's nobody better than me. There's nobody plays better than me. Nobody taught me anything. Nobody can teach me anything. I know everything. It's that, wow, you know, for the love of God, man.
She's, I've played that interview over and over in my head and thinking, could it have gone any other way? And I don't think it could have because we didn't.
No, we're blameless.
Yeah, we didn't trigger her to act like that.
And we didn't goad her or
you know, and
bushwhacker or ambush her.
And then you know, then the next day getting the cease and desist. It's
we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
But still, it's, you know, it's kind of sad.
Yes.
All right.
Because I was a huge Carole Kaye fan. I really was.
Me too.
I mean, I'm still a fan of her music, but not so much a fan of her.
Well, now there's doubt as to whether or not she did or didn't. And, you know, I mean,
there's no doubting like Wichita Lime in that intro because you've sure. heard the artists say.
Even Glenn Campbell. Yeah.
So, I mean, there are things that she did and you can't take that away from her, but it's just, yeah.
All right. Well, you know what? For the sake of it, let's just get it out in the open. Here's the thing. We, Dave and I, about, I don't know how long ago it's been. When we do it, like 3, 4, 5 months ago.
Something like that. Yeah.
We arranged because I had spoken with her some years ago and I had Billy Strange is in common with her as a friend. We contacted Carole Kaye vis-a-vis, I don't remember how I did it, her email or her website or whatever, and asked if she would like to come on, if she would come on the program with us and do an interview with us. And I knew that she loved to talk and she loves to talk about herself, but then I'm not going to smack anybody for that because, hey, I'm good at that myself. The difference is I don't feel threatened when the conversation goes to other people, but that's not the point. She was very excited. I told her what we were doing was, I think it was for a feature thing about Billy, and I wanted her to come on and talk to us about her work with him and all the things that she did. And again, I interviewed her back around 2003, so I knew what we would be getting ourselves into in terms of how much conversation was going to be about anything other than what Carole Kaye did. But that's fine because she's Carole Kaye.
Right.
And she has accomplished a lot for whatever the problems may be. So we did, in fact, talk with her. And we talked with her, and we pre-record 99.9% of our interview stuff. And what was slated to be, we asked her for 20 minutes. I think we talked to her 45, almost an hour. And we were good for about the first 20 minutes or 25 minutes. And then we sort of wandered over into the Wrecking Crew and Hal Blaine. And not by way of, hey, let's light a fuse and see what happens. It was part of her history. So let's talk about it. And things just kind of got a little weird. Then a little touchy, then a little problematic, and then the next thing you know,
she's screaming at us.
Yeah, and we have never played the interview because we were instructed shortly after the phone call ended. I mean, I don't give away any secrets. She apparently got a hold of her attorney, who I'm sure is a very busy guy and has been through the year, as Hal Blaine has attested. And we got, you know, the word that comes to mind, there are two words that come to mind when I think about what was, and we haven't talked about this publicly because we're not allowed by legal restraint to broadcast any of the interview, which is why we never have. And we have no interest in making her, putting her in a bad light intentionally.
No.
We don't do that. We leave that to the shock jock idiots who still can't come up with anything more intelligent than that.
Because trust me, she said some crazy stuff.
She did, to tell you the truth, and I'll be honest with you, because I'm an old fogey guy and almost a contemporary, they're not that much older than I am, I would have edited that stuff out.
Yeah, we wouldn't have made her.
There was a lot of interesting material, and she was a personable guest with us for at least what would have amounted to a good 20 or 25 minutes worth of interview, but because of legal reasons, that's why we haven't heard it. Or that's why we haven't played it, and that's why you haven't heard any of it, and we won't do that because we won't ambush her, and I don't care. There's nothing in there that I would present on our air on this program that would cause their lawyers to have any reason to come back at us and for us to be a problem. It's just a matter of courtesy. She was upset about it. She didn't want it portrayed, and so we've honored that. Mm-hmm. Now, that said, I will say this. Dave and I talk about it every now and then, and we've come to the conclusion that may she live a long and healthful life, but she's pushing 90, and she can't live forever. So God bless if she goes. Boy, we'll have that interview on this program faster than you can hit. Maybe we'll get a call from CNN when that comes around, the last words. But there was a lot of bitterness.
Yes.
Hal Blaine's bitterness, I think, was more just my read on everything we've listened to in this program was like just almost an intellectualizing of it. Like, damn it, she didn't do it. So why do you keep saying that you did it? Not like you're making me look bad. He didn't care. He had a great life, and he seemed to be appreciative of it. She part a lot. In fact, the reason that she got rid of us real quick, and it was not a pleasant situation, was that we were basically being accused of bushwhacking and
yes.
ambushing and trying to steer. And just, it was just, she was threatened.
Yeah.
And so she lashed out, and that was the end of that. And it was unfortunate. Then right. what there are two words that come to mind when I think about that conversation with her. Poignant and just sad.
Sad.
Because it's clear that she's...
And also the email that we got that said we lied to her. We never lied to her.
Right. Of course
not. And we wouldn't lie to her.
Of course not.
You know, we talked about Billy Strange.
Dave and I have made a solid habit all of our adult lives, and I speak for Dave on his behalf, and if I'm wrong, please feel free to step in. Dave and I have made a pact, even just subconsciously, that as long as we've known each other, and for our entire adult lives, we never lie to any woman that we haven't been married to. So that's just a rule of thumb.
Yes. But, I mean, it just, to think that we lied to her and ambushed her, and that was just ridiculous.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, I felt a little, not better, but I felt a little more vindicated, if that's the word. And, again, I haven't lost any sleep over the fact that she upset and dumped us because oh, my gosh, her lawyers are going to come after us. Well, that could be kind of cool if you think about it. But then when Hal Blaine came up with this, and I'd never heard that anecdote before about the reporter who was going to talk to him and then talk to her and talk to her in this business of she went off on him, and that was 10, 15 years ago. So that's kind of been the pattern. So anyway, that's a 90-minute way of teasing the fact that we've got a pretty interesting Carol Kay interview in the can.
Yes.
One of these days we may be able to offer it. But in the meantime, we wish Carol Kay well.
Oh, of course
long,
we do.
Long life.
And as I said, I would say because that came on the tails of me establishing a friendship with Bernard Purdy.
Right.
And I'm like, wow, Bernard Purdy and Carol Kay, I'll be able to send her a Christmas card. I'll get a Christmas card for her. I had all this in my mind. You know, how you build things in your mind.
Sure.
And
marriage number three is memories.
Yeah. And then, you know, her screaming at us and telling us, you know, saying the things that she said. I'm like, well, I guess there's no Christmas cards heading either way.
Well, I'm going to, without risking anything, because I'm not going to tell you specifics, I will tell you very quickly what happened. And when Dave is talking about screaming at us, this is what it was. The conversation started to get into the Wrecking Crew Hal Blaine thing. And in her way, she's as unhappy about what was perceived and what did or didn't happen as Hal Blaine was in his way. They just had two different ways of presenting itself. And she got kind of agitated and she started saying some things that were pretty raw. And then I think in whatever state of mind she may be in at this point in her life, I think she got upset with herself and confused and angry and not sure. And she wasn't sure what she'd said. And it was like somebody that's angry because they don't know what. All I could think of was this. If you've ever seen, and I have no idea what kind of mental or psychological or physical shape she's in at her age, and that's not my business. But if you've ever seen the award-winning Henry Fonda, Katharine Hepburn film on Golden Pond.
Yes, yeah.
The very poignant beginning where they're at their little lake cabin for the first time in the season, and he goes off into the woods for a walk, a forest that he's walked through many, many, many times. And he has Alzheimer's. The character has Alzheimer's. And he realizes he doesn't know where he is, and he gets frightened.
Mm-hmm.
And he's panicking, literally, because he doesn't know where he is, and he doesn't know where to go, and he doesn't know where to turn. And there's kind of a... And I had that sense when Carol got as upset as she did, and she was coming at us, and all of a sudden we were two really nice guys, because you heard the sweeper, hi, it's Carol, okay,
yeah,
and you're listening
to
Dave and Scott and all that. So anyway, it was sad. And one of these days we may be able to share it. Never the salacious stuff, because
no,
that's
no,
just
we're
bullshit.
Not going to share the things that she said. But
unless TMZ is listening and you're willing to pay cash, then if and when, God forbid, Carol Kay, when she goes to that great songwriter studio Wrecking Crew session in the sky, then we'll talk a whole different deal.
Yes. Okay. Yes,
that's all. Anything else?
Just two shows this week. Penn's Landing Friday night with Engine 9, my drum DJ show, and then Saturday Philadelphia, St. Joe's Alumni Center with the Neil Diamond Ultimate Diamond. Okay. Other than that, we're good.
Okie dokie. Next week. And I debated whether or not to use this as the line to promote the next show or not, but I thought, what the hell, next week we do Taylor
Swift.
You disappoint me. I thought
Ham.
It's not fill in the blank.
It's so many, you know.
No, Steve, now it's because you were consciously thinking about it. If you'd gone with your instincts, I knew it was going to be some form of, yeah, we're going to do her all right.
No.
Now you're scared of the football player. That's what's going on. And by the way, we'll talk about this next week. We're doing it because her new album is out, and it's the Beyonce's is the one with 62 tracks on it. Taylor has 107, I think, on her album. And I listened to the entire thing in its entirety. I'm not going to, you talk about Carol Kay going crazy. I'm not going to talk about the Swifties and let them come screaming at us. But I will tell you this. listening to her songs and music. We'll talk about this next week in some detail. The music, we'll talk about that in a different realm. Her lyrics have become extremely poetic and very, in many of the cases, in my opinion, as a listener, very insightful,
mm-hmm.
very poignant, very intelligent, very intellectual. There's a lot of really heavy stuff going on there. But now I'm genuinely curious as to what in the hell she and Travis Kelce talk about when they're not either on opposite sides of the country saying they miss each other or they're in bed. Other than that, this is like, you know, it's like what that wonderful episode of Big Bang when Bob Newhart was guesting and he was kind of enamored of Penny.
Uh-huh.
Then he found out that Penny was Leonard's girlfriend and he turned to Leonard at one point and said, what do you two talk about? Because there's kind of a discrepancy there intellectual output.
Yeah.
But we'll deal with that next week.
Yeah, he's probably not talking. He's probably just throwing her around the bedroom.
Yeah, well, that's romantic. Anyway.
Hey, now.
Next week.
Taylor, hey, now.
Taylor Swift. Hank Kingsley.
Taylor Ham. Taylor Swift.
Yeah, give it up. It didn't work the first time. All right, taking us out, we're going back to Hal Blaine's talents one more time, and one of Paul Simon's most, one of his favorite works is an interview, although he modestly or immodestly says that he never felt like he wrote great stuff. He just wrote some pretty good songs from time to time. This one is gauged to be one of those. And the usual, just exactly what was needed work from Carole Kaye's BFF Forever, Hal Blaine. I'm Scott Edward Phelps.
I'm Dave Simmons.
And I'm Hal Blaine.
And two out of three of us are the Audiophiles.
In the clearing stands a boxer and a fighter by his trade, and he carries the reminders of every blow that laid him down or cut him till he cried out in his anger and his shame, I am leaving, I am leaving, but the fighter still remains.
The Audiophiles is produced in the United States of America. Questions, comments, and witty banter welcome. Audiophilesbroadcast@gmail.com. The Audiophiles.
Hi, I'm Carole Kaye.
Don't get me started.